Hey, it's Sean Fennessy, host of The Big Picture. Did you just see the latest tentpole blockbuster? Or a surprisingly fun new movie on a streaming service? Or maybe you just want to bone up on the greatest films ever made? From reviews to rankings, career retrospectives to movie drafts, and everything in between, The Big Picture is here for you. Listen to The Big Picture for free on Spotify.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
I was a Fred Lynn guy, but I liked all of them.
I was a Fred Lynn guy, too. Outfield, I mean, yeah. Evans, Lynn, and Rice, and then Yastrzemski, of course. Those were my guys. I did, when in 99, at the All-Star game, when they played it at Fenway, I did the celebrity hitting challenge and was on a home run, you know, a celebrity team with Jim Rice.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Was he nice to you?
Oh, he was great. Yeah. He was great. I mean, he was known as kind of being ornery.
Yeah.
That was always his reputation, but he was super nice and was still belting home runs.
Right.
I mean, in 99. So he was probably, gosh, what he would have been, 50s or 40? Late, no, I guess.
Yeah, like late 40s, early 50s.
Late 40s,
yeah.
Early 50s. I guess, so I'm 47. So I guess it's not that surprising.
You still have, you've worn A-Track Power now?
I do. You know, in fact, back then, we got that the night before the All-Star game, the old Greensman there used to do it 20 years ago. I think Joe Moody was his name. And
yeah.
He let us on the field. And I got to go on the field with my dad and with my brother and with a few, like a handful of friends. And we had batting practice from midnight till 1 a.m. And it was.
They put the lights on for you?
They had the lights on because they were literally drawing, putting the lines down for the game. And I hit the wall. My dad was a pitcher in college and I hit the wall, you know, wood bat off my dad. And that was it. It was like with the joke that night, we were driving out of there and we were like, I said, I'm never going to need therapy because like that just happened. And we were saying we should just jump off the Pru. Like that's it. We peaked. We've all peaked. Like just, it was the most awesome. Sean McDonough was there. Sean was one of the people with us. And there was like a handful of people. It was just this unbelievable moment.
What happened on the Oprah show when you got a Pedro jersey?
Yeah, I went on the show and that was after that 99 season when he had the greatest, you know, one of the greatest seasons ever for a pitcher. And out of nowhere, I mean, Oprah being Oprah, you know, I mean, people get cars on that show sometimes, you know, I mean, she's, I have a gift for you. And I was like, oh, cool. You know, I opened this thing and it was Pedro's one of, he had four jerseys. He had two home and two away. And it was one of his travel jerseys for that year.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So
it had the little tag on it.
It's his thing. And he signed it to me. So that was, you know, in terms of like my life becoming totally surreal 20 years ago when, around the time of Rounders.
So it's like Oscars, you hit a double off the wall in Fenway and Pedro gave you a jersey on like a 2-year span.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing you're still here.
And then I realized then that I lived inside the Matrix.
Well, let's go backwards because we want to get to the Rounders stuff. But you, for years and years, you had, it's interesting. We talked about this. We did a Rewatchables podcast about Rounders that we haven't run yet. But we were talking about how you're part of this era of 90s actors. Like when we were growing up, we always heard about the guys from The Godfather.
Right.
And, oh, they idolized Brando. But then this whole new class came out and it was those guys and then De Niro. And your era never is considered to be an era, but it really kind of was an era. And I remember you telling me there was this whole stretch where you guys were all going for the same movies and they were all people that became pretty famous.
Yeah. I mean, out here in the early 90s, there was a handful of, you know, in terms of leading men that, you know, that I would go up against. You know, I mean, it was a lot of the guys in School Ties, you know, the movie that we did, and the guys in Dazed and
Stop
Confused.
Stop it. Like, I like how you pretend I'm not aware of School
No,
Ties.
No, but I mean, you know, it's not, wasn't a big hit movie. It's not like Dazed and Confused, which, although it wasn't a huge hit, it's really a
the
cult.
The big ensemble young cast.
Yeah. And so if you looked around, all those actors who were kind of in those movies that were around then were pretty much the people that would, you'd see, you know, you'd go in, you'd get called back again. It would get whittled down. And you'd see, like, you know, Ben or McConaughey or you know, you'd hear Ed
Was
Norton
Leo in this whole world?
No, Leo was already a star. Yeah. Leo was already, like, you know, because he kind of blew up with This Boy's Life when he was probably 13 or 14. And then he did Gilbert Grape. So yeah. Leo wasn't auditioning for
That
anything.
Was it. He was just snapping his fingers.
Yeah, no, I auditioned for the Basketball Diaries. It was like, Leo's doing the Basketball Diaries. There's another part. Do you want to audition for it? You know what I mean? So he was already, and he's a little younger than us too.
Yeah.
I want to say he's probably 5 years younger than you know, if you look at Ben and me and McConaughey and—
Is Brad Pitt in there?
Brad's older than us, and Brad was also massively famous. I mean, Thelma and Louise was what, 91 or 92?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
so
he was.
So
he
it had
was
already
Brad
happened.
Pitt. I remember working with him. There was something that on Oceans that George wanted us to do. I forget what it was. It was some appearance or something, and Brad said no, and George looked at me and goes, "Well, look," he goes, "You can't really blame the guy. I mean, he's Brad Pitt. And he's been Brad Pitt a lot longer than we've been us." even then, I mean, George kind of subsequently just become this kind of international icon. But, you know, around Oceans, he was transitioning off of ER. I remember the first time we went to Europe on that movie to promote. And George just tells the story of people like stepping over our faces in order to get to Brad. Like, we were completely invisible. We used to send him out like before us because there would be like 1,000 people outside the hotel. And we just say, Brad, walk out to the left. And they would go completely bananas. And George and I would just walk out to the right and just go to dinner. Like, it's no problem. But like,
George is in that class, right?
He is now. But he was, you know,
he's toiling away doing his own thing, trying to get seen.
Yeah, well, he was doing, you know, he was still locked onto his ER contract.
Yeah. I'm talking early 90s, though. He was doing TV pilots, all that shit.
Oh, early 90s. Yeah. Yeah. I think ER was like 94.
Yeah,
94.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, he was, Ben met him at a barbecue. I remember he came back. He said, "I met this really cool guy." He said he's done 10 pilots that have gotten picked up and none of them.
None of them made it.
And they all got made, and then they all either, you know, like they were on for 2 episodes or 8, you know, and then just got canceled.
Did you have one of those, or you just were movies from the get-go?
No, it was always movies. Yeah.
Why was that?
Well, TV was different then. It was a sitcom, which I wasn't interested in doing.
Yeah.
Or it was a procedural, usually, you know, like an hour long, you know, which can start
like you're
out
a young lawyer with a danger streak.
Yes, exactly. And like,
can't settle down.
Ben's ex-wife, Jennifer Garner. Okay. So she was on one, Alias, you know, it starts out, everyone's like, "This is really cool." And she used to make me laugh because she'd go, by the 7th season or whatever, it's like, there's aliens coming down. There's, you know, they're just, it just gets progressively more absurd, you know, and you're pregnant with the alien's baby and it's, "Give me back my baby." And it's just, you know, and everyone kind of knows, it's like, we're just running it into the ground. You know, there are still people watching and Clooney
played it the best way, I think, out of anyone. But he did always, that ER, so he, and he got out as fast as possible.
Which is 5 years.
Yeah.
And they were begging him to renegotiate. And I think, you know, he was making like 25 or 30 grand a week, which is obviously a lot of money. But to put perspective on that, the show was so successful. I mean, people were making hundreds of millions. Like the people who created that show, I mean, forget it. It was just this juggernaut. It was everybody in America. There were 4 channels and everybody was watching ER. And George's last episode, you know, I think Anthony Edwards was making $1 million a week and they had their last scene together and they'd started out together. But Anthony was like, you know, I'm going to stand on ER, I'm doing it. And they paid him what he was worth, right? And they would say, George, just renegotiate. You're going to make so much money. They'd go, no, I want to make movies. You know?
Yeah.
And that's what it was worth to him. So he never complained about it. He just did his job and he played out his contract and did what he wanted to do.
What was your first big break?
It's tough. It depends on how you define, because there's so many of them that, you know, I mean.
Because I always felt like School Ties put you on the map, at least for me. I'm like, who's that guy? Man, is he evil?
Yeah, yeah.
I can't believe I was treating Brendan Fraser. This is totally uncalled for. Yeah.
No, he's a horrible character.
He's really one of the worst characters of all time.
Yeah, really one of the worst that I ever got to play, actually.
Anti-Semite all-star.
Yeah, no, but not an all-star, like a
or an anti-all-star. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy was not a nice guy.
No, not a nice guy.
But made it clear it was going to turn out well for him.
No, he knew it. He knew the deck was totally stacked.
It's gone.
Like, he was the embodiment of like pure white privilege.
Yeah.
You know?
It actually is a really good movie that holds up from a cable.
I hope so. I haven't seen it in a really long time.
Yeah, it's solid.
But that was a huge break for me. And it was a big break because Stanley Jaffe, who was originally directing it, and Sherry Lansing were producing. Now, they had done Kramer versus Kramer. They had also quite famously done Taps. And so they
one of those young ensemble movies.
So they were known as people who really had the eye to, and so to kind of be cast by them, because Stanley was originally the director of the movie, was a kind of a signal effect. You know, people went, oh, these are serious young actors, I guess. And Ben and I both got put in that movie. So that was a big break. But then I went back to college and the phone didn't ring, and you know, I mean, I'd subsequently learn a lot about marketing and how to market, and they marketed it the way they should have, which was around Brendan, because he was the star, and he went off and did Encino Man all after. It was like, okay, this guy's got another movie. He's the star of the movie. We got to blow him up. And then Chris O'Donnell got Scent of a Woman. And
you auditioned for that one, right?
Everyone auditioned for that one. Yeah, everyone auditioned.
It's a great part.
It was one of those parts. It was like, oh my God, opposite Al Pacino. And Chris went in and won it. And so everyone knew that movie was going to be big. And so it was like the marketing kind of emphasis went to those guys. And I remember being really hurt by that. Like, like personally feeling like, well, but I'm nothing like this person that I'm playing in this movie. I'm really good in this movie. Like, why isn't, you know, and I just, you know.
So you think they held that role against you a tiny bit? It's possible.
No. I don't think the whole role got held against me. I think it was just, I wasn't talked about, like those guys were talked about. Like, I remember my brother going, dude, I saw this thing, man, and it was like, you know, they were talking about the two actors who are really going to come off of this movie. And they said, it's Brendan and Chris. And it was because they had work lined up and I was back in school and I didn't have any other job. But I remember feeling like, well, and then that, you know, at any rate, that, you know, so, but it was still a huge break. The idea that I'd been cast in a feature film.
Some say it's the best naked shower fight scene ever.
It's up there, dude. It's up there.
Filming that for 5 days.
Yeah. 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 My God. My God. I think there's probably a lot that was cut out of that too. I mean, Jesus. It was just, yeah.
So you knew Affleck, you knew Affleck before that movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
We grew up,
you know, I mean, he's up the street now and he's still a lot further away than he was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
We were like, we're two tiny blocks away.
So you both get that movie. And now, are you auditioning against each other for parts? Is it like competitive? How does that work?
I mean, technically, I guess, but it was, you know, we were roommates. So it was like, I hope one of us gets it.
Right.
Because, you know, there's when I got Geronimo, that movie with Walter Hill, that paid our rent for a long time. He got this show Against the Grain, which was actually based on Friday Night Lights.
Really?
So yeah, so it was the first iteration of
I think this
a
is
show.
On YouTube. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it was a Friday night, like on one of the major networks, which was their kind of family night of programming, right? Because that's who's home watching TV. And so it was a real family. It was real aw shucks, like, you know, little Davey is, you know, it was like, it was one of those real kind of family shows. It lasted like 8 episodes, but it paid our rent.
Where are you living?
We were in Eagle Rock at that point.
Eagle Rock. You were way ahead of the curve.
We were, yeah, a little too far ahead of the curve. I mean, if you have an audition in Santa Monica on a Friday and you live in Eagle Rock, then fuck, man. I mean,
it was an hour and a half getting home.
Oh, it's more than that. I mean, it's every bit of 2 hours, like each way.
You and Affleck, is it, what's the apartment? How big is it?
Eagle Rock. Oh, there were so many of them. Oh, Eagle Rock was.
Like one bedroom?
Well, the first one, yeah, he was in college. He was at Occidental. So, yeah, the first one was pretty shitty. And then, what did I do? I got Geronimo, and then we got this place. So we had a little money, and this place, we called it the Castle. It was just kind of weird, dilapidated kind of architectural mistake. And it was me and Ben, and Casey had just graduated high school. And he and his other and a friend of his moved out to do a gap year, and Casey was going to audition, and so so it was four of us living in this kind of weird place in Eagle Rock. And then Ben at that point had already dropped out of school, so it was like, why are we living in Eagle Rock?
Yeah.
But anyway,
and then you ended up in LA, and you're in the circuit.
Then we ended up the next, instead of re-upping our lease there, I got a place with another high school friend in West Hollywood. Ben got engaged to this girl and moved in with her. And so it was that moment where we're like, dude, we're going to sign this lease. Like, and he's like, no, I'm getting married. And we're like, you don't seem too excited about it, you know? Really? And he was like, yeah, no, I'm getting, we're happy.
It's going to be great.
We're happy. And I'm like, okay. He was like 22.
You're thinking intervention?
Well, no, I mean, it's not your play. You know what I mean? It's like, what do you say? You know, what are you going to say? You go like,
well, the problem is,
are you sure? Like, are you sure? Cause seriously, we're signing a lease.
Yeah.
Like we need a place to live and we got to get it. We're getting a 2-bedroom or a 3-bedroom. So you tell us, are we getting a 2-bedroom or a 3-bedroom? He's like, get a 2-bedroom. We're like, okay. So me and our friend Soren, who we grew up with, Soren and I got this 2-bedroom on Curson off of Melrose.
Yeah.
And about 2 months later, Ben showed up with all his shit. And we had the only, you know, those little, you know, places on that street. You know, they're great if two people are living there because, you know, you got a little front room, a little living area, and then the kitchen, and then bedroom, right? So Ben showed up there. You know, Ben's a big guy. Like, there's nowhere to put him, right?
Yeah.
And he had all his stuff. So now all his stuff took up our living room and he was trying to sleep on this couch. Like we had this couch, this one of those black pleather couches from IKEA that like, you know, if you're 1 degree warm, like you just stick to it. And like, it's like, and Ben ended up on that couch, which Ben's 6'4", the couch was probably 5'9".
Oh man.
So we go in the morning and his legs would be hanging off the end. And that was, I think, one of the reasons because we were already writing Good Will Hunting, but we finished it in that bungalow kind of apartment in West Hollywood because we were like, this is untenable.
Yeah.
So we're going to work like, we have nothing to do. We don't have jobs. We have enough money that our rent is covered, but we're not going to make it through the lease. Like, so we probably were writing, you know, 12 hours, 16 hours a day. And we had nothing else going on.
And so, Good Will Hunting, the original movie, had this whole second act where he becomes like, let's see, in the CIA?
Yeah, it was the FBI. It was, well, one of our favorite movies all time was Midnight Run.
Yeah.
So it was very much written by two, but like, you know, I was 22 and Ben was 20 when we started that. And we sold that version of it. And I was 24 and Ben was 22. So it was like a movie, an homage to Midnight Run written by these guys from Boston. And it was kind of a hot mess.
Yeah.
But there were some scenes in it that were really good. And it was Castle Rock who bought it. And Rob Reiner, I'll never forget Rob Reiner in a meeting, you know, basically gave us permission to remove all of that high concept stuff. And it was the high concept stuff that kind of sold it because people were like, oh, I can see how this movie will make money.
Yeah.
And Rob was like, we don't believe that here. Like, there's something else here. If you guys just want to explore these relationships, you know, write the movie that you want to write. And we were like, oh, okay, well, we'll write this then. And
you guys were always okay with you being the lead and him being the sidekick?
Yeah, I mean, I'd started it in college in a playwriting class. And so it was all established by the time, you know, that was my final paper was this. I was supposed to write a one-act play.
Yeah.
And I handed in the first act of a movie. And I said to the professor, I think I failed your class because this is not what you asked for, but this is what came out and I really like it. And he gave me an A in the class. And he said, yeah, it was really cool because I didn't get a lot of straight A's at Harvard, you know. And he went, you know, no, he said, wherever this goes, he goes, I don't know where it's going, but stay with it.
Yeah.
And it was really great because I didn't think of myself as a writer. I was an actor and neither did Ben for that matter. And so that was in late January. And then in March, I came out here for spring break to audition for stuff and stayed on Ben's couch. And showed it to him, was like, hey, I wrote this thing and I don't know what the fuck to do with it. And Ben read it and goes, I don't know what to do with it either, but we should do it together. And I was like, sold, I'm in. And so that was really I trusted no one in my life more than him.
Yeah.
You know, and we were just, you know, as he was as close a friend as I'd ever had in my life or ever could imagine having. And I respected him and I respected his taste. I mean, our tastes kind of formed together, you know what I mean? That those kind of teenage years where you're kind of spreading your wings and gaining your own independence and, you know, we did that together. Right. And so, I know he would read a situation the same way I would, you know what I mean? We were just very, compatible in that way. And,
well, the movie then goes into developmental hell for like,
I mean,
almost 2 years.
Yeah. But to be fair, it got a lot out of that process. There was a point at the end where it stagnated with Castle Rock.
Yeah.
But leading up to that point, the movie vastly improved because they allowed us to do, you know, to make the movie that we wanted to make it smaller. And yeah, I mean, it wouldn't have existed the way it did.
At what point was it like, we're only doing this movie if we're in it, where you hit that kind
from the beginning
game of chicken?
Yeah.
Wasn't there when the new studio came in, didn't they tell you like, all right, we'll buy it, but
everyone said they'd buy it without us. Everyone said, you will get so much more money if you just let us do this with Brad and Leo.
Yeah.
You know, and we were like, no. And they would all say there's no precedent for that. And then we would always say Sylvester Stallone.
Those are the only two examples I can think of, though.
Well, I think Chaz Palminteri did it with The Bronx Tale to a certain degree.
Oh, that's a good one, yeah.
But he had De Niro. I mean, De Niro had seen him do the one-act play. And so I'm sure Bob was running interference for just saying, like, no, he's playing that part, period. You know what I mean? But Stallone did it on his own. Stallone just refused. And he was flat broke with, like, a kid on the way. And
yeah.
They wanted Ryan O'Neal to do it, I guess. They offered him like an extra 30 grand or something, and he just said no.
But you had gotten a couple other movies even before this movie got going, right? Before you started filming, you lost all the weight for Courage Under Fire.
Yeah.
That seemed kind of crazy in retrospect. Well, how many pounds did you get down to?
I got down to 139.
Which was like legitimately unhealthy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For me, yeah. I mean, I'm in shape now at
139 is ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean,
horrible. They didn't tell you to do that, right?
I just did it because the guy was supposed to be a recovering heroin addict or not recovering, actually. He was supposed to be a heroin addict. And he was supposed to, and there was this whole thing in that movie where there was flashbacks, and I wanted to just make a strong physical delineation between what he looked like now and what he looked like in the flashbacks, that something had happened, right? There's this incident that the whole movie's about, like what really happened. And it's kind of got this.
It's actually a good movie.
I think so. I haven't seen it in a long time, but it was supposed to have this kind of Rashomon quality where you have different characters telling the same story and you see different versions of this story and you're like, wow, what really happened? But when it got to me, I wanted people to go like, something is really fucked up. Something fucked this guy up. And so I had the idea to lose a bunch of weight, and
Now they would just CGI you.
God, well, they would have to, because I would never do that again. I mean, it was just, it was so existentially, you know.
It seems like every A-list actor has to do that once, where they just either lose a ton of weight or gain a ton of weight.
Maybe.
For a role. Maybe. It's like you just almost have, it's like a rite of passage.
Yeah. I mean, I'd do the CGI now.
So that happened, but I was living in Charlestown when you guys actually got greenlit to make Good Will Hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the Improper Bostonian, they had you guys on the cover.
Uh-huh.
And it was in this coffee shop that I always went to. And it was like, look at these young Boston kids making good. They're making their own movie. And I remember flipping through it and being like, oh, the guy from School Ties.
Yeah, right.
Oh,
right.
We
had worked. I mean, you have, yeah, that's a pretty deep knowledge then. Because most people, like when Good Will Hunting came out, people were like, oh, you're an overnight success.
No.
And we were like.
No, you'd been in a bunch of stuff.
I was in the union when I was 16. Like, I'm not, you know.
And Dazed and Confused, Affleck had been in some stuff too, but Dazed and Confused, like O'Bannon was like a real breakout character.
People knew him from that. And then Kevin Smith.
Like, yes.
And Kevin Smith was a huge part of getting us to Miramax.
And was Chasing Amy, that was before Good Will Hunting, right?
That was before. So Ben was like.
That was an intense movie.
Yeah, yeah. And Ben was like the kind of indie darling.
Yeah.
And then he kind of flipped from the indie darling to Good Will Hunting came out, and then he was in Armageddon. And everyone's
right.
Like, oh, he's a big popcorn movie star.
Yeah. I remember reading that thing, and for some reason it just stuck with me. Like, oh, that looks interesting. But never thinking it would be what it became.
Right.
And then you had like this whole, it was in the height of the whole people like leaking stuff, trying to undermine the Oscar campaigns of other movies and stuff.
Yeah.
You had to deal with this whole thing about you didn't really write the movie.
Yeah, that
which was ridiculous.
Well, that was the thing. We were like, but we have like the hard drive. Like not only did we write the movie, we wrote 1,000 fucking drafts of this thing. You know what I mean? Like that everybody's read. But it wasn't. That was a kind of interesting wake up to the kind of the politics of award campaigns, which have only gotten more insane. But that somebody would put that out there, and it wasn't meant to be a story that anybody believed. It was meant to be a story that came out timed perfectly. So at the moment somebody was writing in a name on their ballot, they'd go, "Huh, maybe I shouldn't write that. Maybe I'll write the other one." And that's all. It's just, I just want you to just change what, don't write Good Will Hunting, write this movie instead. That's all it was. And I remember actually Ted Talley, who's a great writer, he wrote Silence of the Lambs. And Ted Talley was one of the people who said, somebody said wrote the movie. And I subsequently worked with him on All the Pretty Horses years later, but I had never met him. And he did an interview. He called Variety and said, you know, it's being reported that I actually wrote this movie and gave it to these guys. And he goes, I just want to say for the record that I wish I wrote this movie. And he just did this really, you know, and it just, he didn't have to do that. You know what I mean? It was very, just, I remember feeling like, wow, he's a big heavy hitter in this business. And he just really did us a solid and kind of put that one to bed. But.
And then you got The Rainmaker before Good Will Hunting, right?
That's what got it green lit.
Yeah.
So. I was so we had been at Miramax in development for a year.
Yeah.
And Gus had fallen out of negotiations because he wanted Final Cut and Harvey wouldn't give him Final Cut. And then I got the deal fell apart, and then Harvey was trying to find other directors, and there was a great Sidney Lumet story because Sidney Lumet, I think, was 72 at the time.
Oh, wow.
Read the script.
One of the greats.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when the Gus thing was ended, they said, "How about Sidney Lumet?" And we said, "Are you kidding me?" Like
the verdict.
Yeah, of course. And we'd read his book, obviously making movies, and Sidney read the script. And the word that came back was once he found out he couldn't have Final Cut, he said, "I love this movie and I'd like to direct it." And he said to Harvey Weinstein, he said, "With all due respect, I wouldn't direct this movie with your dick without Final Cut."
And
that was it. That was just over. We were like, that's what Sidney Lumet said to Harvey. Like, that's amazing.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app. just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
So then I got the Rainmaker on a totally, you know, separate track, because Ben and I still had these.
Is that another one of those things you're competing against the 10 other guys you've been competing against constantly?
Not only that, that one was more interesting because that was the first time I met Edward Norton.
Yeah.
So Primal Fear was a movie that came around and was this unbelievable role. It was like Scent of a Woman. This is going to blow up an actor. I remember I hired a dialect coach that I couldn't even afford to get to prep for that audition.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was a big one. It was like, you're done if you get this. And it was actually one of the things that helped me understand. And Ben and I had a real come to Jesus meeting about it. I remember because when we both got close and didn't get it, and this guy named Edward Norton got it. And that was when we realized, what are the odds, right? That a movie with a role that's great for one of us is going to make it all the way through the ranks of established actors who are all going to have to pass on it. And then it's going to get thrown out into the open here into this jungle with all of us. And the thousand of us are going to go for it. Like, what are the odds that you're actually going to get one of these parts that's going to change your life? And we were like, fuck this. We got to write this thing. We have to write it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen if you wait for it. And yeah, there are the people who do it and it happens, but it's like, if that's your strategy, it's not. You know what I mean? It's such a Hail Mary.
So you had like School Ties, Brendan Fraser, Scent of a Woman, Chris O'Donnell, Primal Fear, Ed Norton. Those are three parts in 6 years.
Yeah.
That transformed somebody.
Yeah. I mean, there were other ones that came along, like Powder. People thought it was going to be a big movie. I remember that, you know, I got close on that one. I can't remember. There were a bunch of movies. I was, you know, it was the same group of people around, a lot of them. And so at any rate, so when The Rainmaker came along, The Rainmaker was interesting because I got a phone call. I'd been tracking it because I knew Coppola was doing it. And that was obviously, you know, my guy, the Godfather. And you know, it's like all of these actors, and he was legendary for how he worked with actors. And Patrick called me and he said, okay, because we couldn't get an answer from them. About where I should go and when. And Patrick finally called and said, listen, he's screen testing people in Memphis. You're not going to get it. He said, I put your chances at 5%. Edward Norton's going down there.
Uh-oh.
And I'm like, fuck. Yeah, and you know, because Edward's not only done Primal Fear at that point, he's done Milos Forman's movie, right?
Yeah.
People versus Larry Flynn, and everyone's saying he's fucking amazing in it, right? So he goes, but there are three actresses that they're reading, and they only have two actors, Edward being one of them. Patrick's like, it's a Hail Mary. And he's like, will you go to Logan Airport right now? And I was like, yeah. And so I flew to Memphis and that next day screen tested for Coppola. And that night, Edward and I went out and hung out. You know, we had like a night on Beale Street together.
Where really?
Like, yeah. And because I just, you know, I mean, he was a guy, I mean, he's my age, incredible actor, like this guy that I just really admired. And I remember that night just saying to him, like, well, I mean, it's really fucking cool meeting you, man. Have fun making the movie. Like, I really thought that, you know, it's done. And then over the next, it took like two like agonizing weeks where they went back and forth between us. Like, it's looking good. It's not looking good. It's looking good. And it just, and then I got the call that I got it. And then that was the most.
How much money was that one?
How much money?
Yeah, I know you remember.
Did I make $600,000? Which was,
I bet if we went through your IMDb, you could remember the price of most of them.
The early ones, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that one. Cause the most,
600,000 is a lot.
It's a fortune.
It's Jesus.
A fortune. But I was the lead of the movie.
Yeah.
It was like a 100-something day shoot. I mean, this was a long, long, long movie.
In Memphis? But
in Memphis. Yeah. And then San Francisco at the end, we did the stage stuff up in San Francisco. But the most I'd ever been paid for. I mean, I'd been paid $100,000 for Courage Under Fire.
Yeah.
And Good Will Hunting had not been made, but Ben and I had sold the script for $600,000, which we split.
Nice.
And then I had a deal for Good Will Hunting if it went that I'd get $350,000.
Did you guys get points with that movie or no?
No. No. No.
But you made up for it later.
Yes. Yeah. It completely. Well, Robin, who's actually who did, you know, Robin made this incredible deal where he, if the movie made over $60 million, he started to get some kind of escalating participation. And it was like, he read it and he's like, he just got it.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, oh, this is cool. We're getting Robin Williams cheap because he was the biggest movie star in the world. And I think he got $20 million a movie. And I think they paid him like five, right? And so they were like, well, great. Well, we're winning here. And then it just turned out Robin just...
He had the last laugh.
Robin crushed him. So we never begrudged him that because it was that also, you know, gets a movie made.
So you finished Rainmaker and then you knew you were doing Good Will Hunting right after that.
Yes, because when I got the part, I sent a fax to Miramax and I said, I think I said, I am the Rainmaker.
Yeah.
And Harvey called him. What the fuck does that mean? He thought he was going to get sued.
Didn't he have some quote like, wait a second, those things make a shitload of money or something like that?
No, his quote was the Grisham movie. And I said, the Coppola movie.
Yeah.
And he goes, all those Grisham movies make $100 million.
Yeah.
And so he instantly calculated that the faster he could get Good Will Hunting onto the screen, he could piggyback off of what was potentially a really big movie. It ended up not being a bit. I don't remember what The Rainmaker made, but it didn't make $100 million. But it was good. I mean, I remember.
What's funny, though, is over and over again, Hollywood tries to go for these proven whatever faces. And the ones that take off so often are the ones like what happened with you and Ben and Good Will Hunting. Like people love discovering new stars every once in a while, but Hollywood never seems to realize that. Like it's okay to give somebody their biggest break.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
It certainly worked out for you guys because you guys became the marketing campaign for the movie.
Yes.
It's like, oh man, all these guys, they tore it away. And it was such a good Cinderella story. It became part of the reason to root for that movie. It was also a very good movie.
There was a great quote of one of the marketing people. We had a meeting at Miramax before the movie came out and guy came in and he goes, I can't, this story is so unbelievable about the backstory of this movie. It's like the most unbelievable thing. And there's this pause and he goes, and it's all true. And I remember thinking like, oh, okay. So normally you don't normally have the benefit of it all.
Right.
True.
You have to like fudge
some of it.
Yes, it
is all true. So enjoy that.
Did you know it was going to hit like it did?
No. I mean, Ben and I always said, we say if it's just a videotape on our mantle, like we want to like it. We want to like it. And that was the only kind of yardstick by which we'd measure success or failure because we assumed that it wouldn't be a big hit. You know, if it was Bottle Rocket or if it was, you know what I mean? If it was a movie that we loved, but like didn't make $100 million, that'd be fine with us.
It was pretty tough for that to happen. With Robin Williams being in it.
Well, that changed everything. Yeah, that changed everything. And that part had been, you know, we called that our Harvey Keitel part because of Reservoir Dogs. And we had heard that Reservoir Dogs got made because Harvey Keitel said yes, and that got the funding. So we said, we need a Harvey Keitel part. So we wrote specifically a role that was really, it could have gone anywhere from, you know, from a Harvey Keitel or a De Niro or an Ed Harris or a, you know, or a huge massive star like Robin or Tom Hanks or somebody like that. It could have gone Meryl Streep. You know what I mean? We could have with some rewrites and then it becomes more of a son mother relationship.
Yeah.
It could have gone Morgan Freeman. You make Morgan from Roxbury and he's from, and then you bring in kind of elements of racial tension around Boston, you know, that both of them would have been.
That wouldn't
in.
Have been hard to pull in.
Right.
With the Will Hunting character.
Yeah. Right. Guy from Southie, right?
Yeah.
At that time. Right. So, so it was made to be a part to be kind of as flexible as possible because we were just trying to get it made. So that was a kind of a bit of calculation, I guess. But what once was, Robin took it, Robin, you know,
what was it like to be on the set on him? Cause he was so freaking famous in the mid 90s.
Yeah, that was our first big exposure. I mean, I had maybe 2 days of working with Denzel on Courage Under Fire.
Oh, yeah.
But we were on like a military base, I think. And so it was pretty contained. And I'd shot with Meg Ryan out in the desert, but we were way out in El Paso. And that was, so there wasn't a lot of that craziness. But with Robin in Boston, yeah, it was nuts. I mean, it was people hanging out the windows, and a lot of people would scream Mork when he walked by.
I mean, it was only 15, 16 years earlier.
That I guess so. Sense. I mean, yeah. To us, it seemed like so long ago. And his body of work in between had been so vast and kind of, if you think of the movies that guy had done.
Yeah.
From, you know, The Fisher King to Good Morning Vietnam to Dead Poets to just on and on and on. And then all the Mrs. Doubtfire. I mean, you know, all of those massive Jumanji, all that stuff. So so to be calling him Mork seemed a little.
That's classic Boston. You call
that Boston, yeah. Boston, I know who you are.
Yeah, hey.
I know you fucking Mork. Don't try to be something you're not.
Who are you? You think you're better than us, Mork?
Yeah, you think you're better than me? Come on, Mork, stop it.
That was the best thing about the Will Hunting character for me. Having spent so much time in Massachusetts. Like the perfect, you think you're better than me kind of edge.
Right.
There just hadn't been a character like that. Or Chucky or any of those guys.
Chucky,
like,
yeah.
What was the Kohauser's character name?
Billy.
Bill, like, it's a good engine. It's yeah, a good, like, good that engine, guy, yeah. I knew those guys.
Well, Cole did this incredible thing while we were making the movie. Like, he gave away almost all of his lines to Casey.
Really?
Yeah, he goes, look, guys, I see that, because we'd written it for him. And he goes, and we'd written the other part for Casey, obviously. So he goes, I see that you guys like are trying to pad the part out to make me want to do it. He goes, but I want to do it because I want to do your movie with you guys. And he goes, and in every one of these groups, there's always one guy who's quiet. And
yeah,
and who's,
he was right.
Yeah. And he's right. And who's serious. Like there's shots and you look at him, you go like, I do not want to fuck with that guy at all. Like
he's the quiet guy who is also the first guy you want if anything goes down.
If shit goes down, yeah, exactly.
He's the guy.
And so he did, so he wrote his own lines. He just gave them to Casey. Because there's always a loudmouth in the group too.
Right. Yeah. Is there ad-libbing or had you done this stuff so much at that point? There was no
Casey, there was, you know.
Because he ad-libbed like the baseball glove scene and some other stuff.
The baseball glove was just in the house where we were, and he came down with the glove. And that's what, I'm laughing in that scene. I'm not even supposed to be laughing. It's like, you know, I just couldn't help it. He was so funny. And he also, like, the first day of shooting, we were shooting the scene where he was asking for, his line was, can I get my double burger? And there was this old show. Remember when we were kids? It was called, it was that game show, Big Bucks, No Whammies.
Oh, yeah. Press Your Luck. Yeah.
Press Your Luck. So we always watch Press Your Luck. Like if you were homesick, you were like, watch Press Your Luck. And Ben and I really early on started talking about acting. You know, they say you make choices, right? You make a choice. That's a bold choice or whatever. We talk about it in terms of going into the whammy business. Like if you were, you know, the point of Press Your Luck is, you know, you're trying to press the button and you don't want a whammy. If you get a whammy, then the thing takes all your money away.
Yeah.
But if not, you can make a few thousand bucks or whatever. But we always talked in terms of how much are you risking? Like, what are you, you know, are you just playing it straight down the middle or are you going to go into the whammy business a little bit and, you know, I don't know, drop a bunch of weight for Courage or do, you know what I mean? You know, whatever, any little kind of moves we'd made career-wise.
Chasing Amy was
going into the whammy business, yeah. Right? So we talked about that. And the first take on Casey, he's sitting in the back seat and he literally goes, Chuck, can I get my double burger? And Ben and I turn around and he's like, what the fuck? Like, this is the thing we wrote. Like, and he just looks at us and goes, sorry, guys, I'm going deep into the whammy business. And there's nothing you can do. You're like, all right, yeah. He's going. And he's brilliant in the movie. And it really works like that. He brings something that no other character is doing. And it's like the right color for that.
So the movie takes off.
Yeah.
You get Rounders.
Yeah.
Rounders is your next movie. You've already decided to do Rounders before Good Will Hunting even came out, or did it already come out?
No, it hadn't come out. It was, we started shooting Rounders in December of 1997. And so Good Will Hunting came out, I think it was December 11th, 97, and it opened in LA and New York, and then it opened nationwide in January. So the first month of that movie, Good Will Hunting was kind of coming out to really good reviews, and I was doing like talk shows and interviews while I was starting to shoot Rounders, like to promote it, you know.
And then it got going.
Yeah.
Why Rounders? What was it about the script? What jumped out at you?
Well, so when Harvey bought Good Will Hunting from Castle Rock, he got Ben and I both in these option deals that, you know, he had a lot of leverage on us. He could have asked for 10 options. I think he asked for 3 each, which basically meant I preset your price for 3 movies.
Yeah. Right?
And I remember saying to Patrick and Ben at the time, like, fuck, if me, because Miramax was making the best stuff back then. And it was like yeah, all the Quentin stuff and Anthony Minghella. And I was like, they want to preset my price to whatever they want. I'll take it. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, we wanted to work.
Yeah.
And then when Good Will Hunting blew up and it looked like it was going to blow up, it was like, well, it's like a rookie contract. You just try to, you get through it and so that you can go out onto the, you know, and you know, get more money to do the same thing.
You're like Jason Tatum on the Celtics.
Right.
You know the big nine-figure right. contracts coming down the road.
Exactly.
Just try to win some games.
Not to compare myself to the great Jason Tatum.
I didn't mean to besmirch his great name.
Yeah, please. but it was like, oh my God, we're taking off and the three movies, I was just thinking about this before you got here, because the three movies that I did to fulfill those obligations were Rounders, Dogma, and The Talented Mr. Ripley. So,
wow.
Yeah, so Harvey had three good scripts. So I lined them right up and I did them and knocked them out. And then I never worked for Miramax again, which is weird because I'm one of the people who's really connected to that time. And I mean, I guess I worked for him a lot in that time, but
into the Harvey stuff and it was just weird. It was like, yeah, you worked for the guy. I don't even know what your role is, but like, I'm not going to ask you about it. And it's not like I'm wussing out because, oh, God
no,
damn,
no,
it's like, I just don't know what you're supposed to do in that situation.
I don't know. I think a lot of people said, you know, well, you knew or everyone knew. And I always just say, but knew what? Like, I've worked for, I don't know how many studio heads at this
yeah.
point. I have no idea what any of them do when they go home. I don't hang out with
Why
them.
Why would you know?
I wouldn't. Like, if they were my friends, if I was like rolling around with them and like you, then.
But you're going to Vegas with them on the weekends and shit
right,
like that.
Right. Like, yeah. I never hung out with any of these people. Like, they're my bosses, right? Like,
yeah.
they say yes or no to movies that I want to do. And so we're connected for that 6 months, and then we take a picture at the premiere, and then, you know, they go off and make other movies, and I go off and make other movies. So, but I just feel like that, you know, when all that stuff was coming out, I think there was so much that was systemic about it that I think that's what people went, well, fuck, everybody around him must have known everything. And,
yeah.
And that's just not true. That's, yeah. that's not what happened. And then I started to think about like how connected I was to him. And then I was like, well, wait a minute. I haven't worked for him since 99. Like,
I didn't realize you only did the three and then you were
I
done.
Didn't either.
By the way, that's a fantastic quartet.
It's great. No, he get to his credit, you know, because option deals, people normally, they can get stuck. You can get stuck. They can, yeah. You can get forced to do something, right?
Yeah.
I got four, you know, to come out of there with Good Will Hunting and Rounders and Dogma and Ripley. It was great. And and All the Pretty Horses was a co-production with Sony, but it wasn't part of my deal.
In
2003, I shot the Brothers Grimm for Dimension, which is Bob Harvey's brother.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
I think one of the best defenses of your career, of like if you're an athlete, people are making the cases for you, like with Brady.
Right.
People talk about Rodgers as the GOAT. I'm like, well, Brady has 5 Super Bowl rings and threw for 505 yards in the last Super Bowl, and Rodgers has 1 ring. If we argued about actors that way, the Good Will Hunting, Rounders, Ripley, those 3 characters are so different. It's good. It's a good feather in your cap.
Thanks,
Ripley's
man.
Fucking creepy. That movie's on all the time.
Yeah, I
it's
haven't
on the
seen
cable.
That in a long time.
It's really weird and disorienting and unsettling.
Anthony was really, really locked in and really knew what he wanted to do. I remember loving it when it came out, and it didn't really get the due that it deserved. It didn't get nominated
it
for
does
Best
now.
Picture.
No, it's belatedly gotten it, I think.
I hope so, because it was really well done. And but like I remember thinking, well, if I wait 10 years, because you see the movies right when you make them, but it's kind of impossible to judge them. And I remember thinking, if I wait 10 years, then I can watch. And then 10 years passed, and I was like, that's maybe 20 years. And now it's like 20 years has passed on all these things, and I still have to sit down and watch them because I feel like I could be more objective. It's just, it's harder to watch myself young, actually, than it is to, you know, watch rough cuts of shit I'm working on now.
I had Denzel on the pod 2 months ago, and he just doesn't go backwards at all. He just goes to the next job. He doesn't.
I understand that. About his I mean, that's that might be where I end up because I haven't been able to go backwards yet either. And you know, we did a. They had one of these, you know, 20-year things, but it was a. The New York Times does these readings of screenplays, but they cast them with different actors.
Yeah,
and so Krasinski was. I had dinner with him. Last year, when he goes, I'm directing the Good Will Hunting one. And he goes, would you ever do it? Would you do the reading? And I go, yeah, when is it? And I go, actually, I might be in New York. Then, yeah, I'd do it. And then I called Ben, and Ben was going to be in New York. And so as a surprise, we came out and we read our script. And neither of us had read it, you know, literally since we... So the production draft was the last time. You don't go back and you never revise it again. It was like, that was it. That was... And we read from, and it was a really emotional thing. Like I didn't, had I realized it was way more special than like the Academy Award, anything. Like had I known it was gonna, it was just this thing. Krasinski was like, will you come do this? And I was like, sure. And it, for Ben and I both, I think it was a really like, when we got in there and we heard the energy of the crowd and people knew, it was like they knew these lines. It was like, holy fuck, you know this 20 years later. Like it really was special. And
no, that movie definitely has long legs. Cause like we do this Rewatchables podcast that where we basically deep dive these different movies. We did Midnight Run, ironically, which is one of my favorite ones ever. It was like one of the lowest listened to podcasts out of all the Rewatchables.
Is that right? Oh my God.
Good Will Hunting, I think, was the number one highest. And we've done like, I mean, we've done probably 60 movies at this point, but I think that's just become one of those, it's like the definition of a rewatchable. Which is why we want to do this Rounders thing, because Rounders was another one that there was no sign at all that this was going to happen with Rounders.
Not at all. In fact, it lost money.
It was pulled from the theater in 3 weeks.
We lost. Yeah, it was. And I mean, I remember my whole life was changing, right?
Yeah.
In a really,
as you're filming Rounders.
Yeah. And in this really profound way too, where like, it's just your code gets rewritten for the Matrix, right? So just your subjective experience changes.
Yeah.
The world is exactly the same, but it's totally different for you. And it's such a mind fuck. And I see why people go crazy and they, you know, people without a solid support really get fucked up. And because it's a head trip.
Well, because it's you're doing the same thing you're doing every day, but everybody around you is acting differently.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's just an odd and unrelenting experience. But I remember the the positive part of that was while your life is imploding, my career was exploding and I was getting to do this thing that I always wanted to do, which was work all the time.
Yeah.
And so when John Dahl showed up, Cole Hauser was away doing a movie and I was house sitting for him. And I remember when John came and met me, we were over in Griffith Park at Cole's house. And I was like, because Harvey was like, you want to do this movie? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, well, for directors, I was thinking, you know, John Dahl. And I was like, you mean Red Rock West and The Last Seduction? Like, fuck yeah, really? Will he do it? And Harvey's like, yeah, he'll do it. And so it's like, suddenly we got John Dahl. And it's like, oh my God, I love this guy. And then I meet him and he's like, well, for this part of Worm, you know, I was thinking maybe, you know, Edward Norton. I'm like, Edward Norton? You think he'll do it? He's like, yeah, he'll do it. And it was, he just kept naming these. It was like John Turturro. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? And I couldn't believe that all these people wanted to.
Malkovich.
And then Malkovich, yeah, who was just like.
Did you know anything about poker?
No. I mean, I played in kind of the classic home game, like with my dad, where everyone, you bring chips and dip and you play these fucking stupid games, you know, like baseball. And like, you know, it's like, you know, there's 18 wild cards and some guy wins $100, somebody loses $100, you know, but nobody really gets hurt and you drink beer. And like, that was poker. And so part of the, you know, getting to know, you know, Brian and David and, you know, who end up being lifelong friends of mine and who, you know, but Brian was and David were both very dialed into what was then this really cool underground scene. You know, it was you had to go like you got to go look up into the camera and get buzzed through a steel door, and you know it felt like fuck, this is cool. Like
this this is a world.
This is a whole world. This is subculture that I didn't know existed. And
you're kind of the poker profile, smart, competitive guy.
Yeah, though now it's like
poker is dangerous for us.
But the game is now like so far, it's evolved. Like I don't know how many.
But you guys started playing though, right?
We did. We started playing.
Got into it.
Yeah, I mean, we got into it like, but not to the extent that some like Toby Maguire is a fucking legit poker player. Like he's really good. Ben won the state title out here in California 14 years ago or something. He got really into it. But even since then, the game has really evolved. I mean, it's all deep, deep game theory now. And these kids coming up on the internet are watching, they're playing 10 hands at once all day. Like they've seen, you know.
They've seen every variation.
They've seen every variation of everything. And a lot of the times they're playing because they don't want to get their play. You know, it's like that great, there's a great play in football last year where Tony Romo, where the Patriots let up a score at the end and Romo just goes, oh my God, that's so gross. He's just doing that to mess with the analytics because like it's a meaningless score and he never puts five people here in the box. He's like, he would never do that. You know, he goes, he's just doing that so that it looks like sometimes he does this and sometimes he does that. No, when it matters, he does this and only this and it didn't matter. And so he's just fucking with the other coaches right now. And that's what these people playing poker now are just are playing a game within a game within a game within a game. And it's just so far beyond them. Like the math, like I was talking to Brian about it recently, like the math, you just have to be just lead pipe on the math. It's like, that's a no brainer. But the game theory beyond that is just, it's beyond my comprehension where the game's gone.
They told a story that we have in the oral history about they were at playing poker with some guy who was a friend of yours. And was talking about movies, and they were like, we're doing this movie, and they're like, no way. And he ends up calling you and Affleck, and you guys showed up and played poker, and that's kind of the first time you all hung out.
Yeah, it was at the
bike. You remember that one?
Yeah. A friend of ours was at the bike, and he called up, and he goes, there are these dudes down here who said they wrote your next movie. And that was before, I mean, that was really early on in the whole thing. Like, I don't think I'd met Dahl at that point. I think it was like, we're going to get John Dahl. And it was like, wait, the guys who wrote Rounders? I was like, I'll be right there. And,
Yeah,
and we went and hung out. And I watched Brian play because I didn't play Hold'em. I didn't, you know. And then he gave me, I mean, I remember he gave me like the super system. And he gave me, you know, kind of the all the books that were kind of relevant at that time. And but that year, I mean, to promote that movie, they bought Edward and I into the World Series. And
that was smart.
Yeah.
I actually remember knowing about that when it was happening. Like people writing news stories about it.
Right,
and stuff.
Right. And it was 20 grand they were going to lose and they got all those stories out of it. Because But it was 350 people.
Yeah.
And they announced that year, I remember, I believe it was 350. So you were 350 or 700, but whatever it was, it had doubled whatever the last year's entries had been. And they were like, and there was a big cheer that went up in the at Binion's. Because
is it true you lost to Doyle Brunson and he knocked you out?
Yeah, I had kings. He had aces.
So that's a true story because that was on the internet. I never know.
Yeah,
on the internet.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's
you lost to Doyle Brunson, who's so famous, he has a hand named after him.
Yes, the 10 deuce.
He knocked you out with two aces.
He did, and which was great because I'd been sitting there. I mean, playing like a donkey. I mean, I was just sitting there, just
yeah,
not doing anything because all I was thinking was I got to last as long as I can. I can't go out in the first session. I got to go to get to the piss break, and then I got to I wonder if I just donk off all my chips. Like, can I make it to the second day?
Yeah.
Right. Cause that would be a good story. And, you know, and then I got kings and there was a raise and a re-raise. I mean, in retrospect, I could have got away from him, but I had $6,500 in chips at that point. And I'm like, it's Doyle Brunson. This is going to be good either way.
I think that's a good, yeah. I think it played out pretty well.
No, it did. And I remember
it's like going against like Belichick or something.
Yeah. You're just like, what the fuck? Nobody expects me to win. I'm just going to, it's like Pete McNeely.
Yeah.
Against Tyson. Yeah. Like, I'm not going to sit in the corner. I'm going to come out and just throw haymakers and confuse the shit out of him.
But I think this is the problem with these guys 20 years later. And this work, because there's so many people in the World Series of Poker and people want to have their story of going head to head against the pros. And I think it's hard for them to win now because they don't know what anybody has.
They don't know what anybody has. And people aren't playing with any discipline because they're behaving differently because they want to say that they played with Bill Simmons, right?
Yeah.
So I got involved in a hand with him. So yeah, it's become really hard for them.
Did you think Rounders was going to do well?
I never know if anything's going to do well. I mean, I liked it.
Because you think about, this is one of the reasons we wanted to do oral history. It was one of these slow burn movies that the 90s had that doesn't really happen as much anymore. You still see it sometimes, like John Wick, I think, was an example of like it came out, kind of came and went, and then became a thing. But like this happened over and over again in the 90s. It happened Swingers, Dazed and Confused. Rounders was another one. It came and went. It was the first Matt Damon post Good Will Hunting movie and was gone in 3 weeks. And then it started showing up on cable.
Yeah.
And then
poker took
then
off.
Poker started going.
And that really helped. I think, you know, when the World Poker Tour and, you know, you started to see people's hole cards and watch how they played and it just caught on and the game exploded.
After it came out, were poker people talking to you and like, did they feel like it was their movie? What was the reaction?
Yeah. I mean, you know, poor Seidel still is like, every time I see him, he's like, oh God, man. He's like, you killed me. Like showing the worst moment of my life. You know, it's like.
We were talking about, we did the rewatchables. We were talking about how he's the big loser of that whole movie. Because he had like a top 10 career.
Oh, he's a genius.
He's in that Rounders movie as the guy
player.
Who gets worked.
Yeah. And he's an incredibly nice guy. Like he's, you know, he's a guy you really root for. So he was like, he through no fault of his own was the big loser in that whole thing.
Mike McD?
Yeah.
What's your mindset with Mike McD? Because basically this guy just has a gambling problem and he's full of shit. And he's got this one friend that he loves, but now you got to take that and turn it into something.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Because
that's like a leading man, old school leading man. You got to carry this. Yeah. I have to root for Mike McD.
Right. I think you have to believe that what was probably more the case then, as you were just saying, like that he was a top 10 player and that it's not gambling, especially back then, right? Like there was a lot more soft money around. Like people know how to play the game. It's like jujitsu now. Like everybody knows the guard, right? But like 20 years ago, they didn't. And 20 years ago, a player of that skill level would, you know, actually could probably live pretty well.
Right.
You know,
what do you remember from the Coppolam Levine script? Like, do you remember thinking this is rich and different and feels like I haven't read anything quite like this?
Yeah. Yeah. And I just remember believing all of the relationships. I love the way the relationship with the worm character. It's just everyone has that friend, you know what I mean? And you're just like, fuck, you're just nothing but trouble. You're just nothing but trouble. You can't. You know, but you can't.
The black cat in your life.
Yeah. And you just see it with every decision they're going to make. They're going to make the wrong decision. Just like it's, you're going to get fucked. You're going to get your nose is going to get broken. Like,
right.
You know.
But did you think Norton could do that? Because Worm was such a scumbag. He hadn't really played anybody like that.
I think a guy can do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he, you know, at that point, he'd done Primal Fear. But, the, you know, The People versus Larry Flint was, you know, and he was working on American History X. He had shot it and he was in the editing room and he gave me a rough cut of that to watch, like, while we were making Rounders. And I was like, holy fuck.
Why didn't you talk him out of the two-hand reverse dunk in the pickup game?
Well, I mean, there's a certain point, then you're only talking to somebody's ego and it's not worth it. You go, dude, that, you know.
Come on, man. Just make it a one hand.
The thing on the curb is unforgettable.
Oh, my God.
But like the two hand dunk is unforgettable for the wrong reasons.
So that movie takes off. But belatedly, it's like this belated success. It's like you get bounced from the playoffs in year one. Or in round one, but then 5 years later, you find out that you actually like won some award that you didn't realize you won.
You're the Sacramento Kings.
Yeah, you're the Sacramento Kings. You like the moral the victory champs. You're the 0-2 pseudo champs.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's also the business is so different. Like there was a DVD market, right?
Yeah.
And it's just evaporated. It's gone. So that was... I asked a studio head recently when we were promoting The Martian. I asked Jim Giannopoulos, like, what was the real effect of that? And he said 50%. 50% of business has been cannibalized by, well, it's just technology, right? And
yeah.
It's different ways to deliver this stuff. But in very real terms for us, that's why the movies have changed. That's why they won't make Rounders anymore. They won't make Good Will Hunting. They can't.
They would make it if he was a superhero.
Yeah, but I mean, so... But they wouldn't even make Rounders.
If he came from Mars to play poker.
Well, see, what it's been kind of replaced with is the international box office, right? And so what you want are movies that are big and really understandable to people all around the world across language and culture.
Yeah.
So that means talk less, make things more simple. White hat, black hat, superheroes. Like, it makes total sense, right? Everybody knows who the good guy is. Everyone knows who the bad guy is. And you know, and they spend $400 million and blow a lot of shit up and like you get your money's worth. And conversely, you can't put Rounders or Good Will Hunting into a movie theater up against that stuff.
See, I'm wondering if Netflix is going to fix that to some degree.
Everybody's wondering that. Everyone's wondering what's going to happen.
Because think about what they've done with like rom-coms and like teen common, like the stuff my daughter likes.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was making those movies for 8-9 years. And right. That Netflix clearly had some algorithm. And
yeah.
They realized like, oh, like your daughter or my daughter, it's like they're underserved. Let's make movies for these people.
I hope so. I mean, there's like the movie that's really gone is like the $20 to $70 million or $15 to $70 million drama. There's just, you know, a lot of that's migrated to TV and yeah, all right. So.
Well, Rounders is the type of movie that's just gone.
Yeah.
Nobody's
I remember seeing, we took Behind the Candelabra to the Cannes Film Festival because it was an international release in theaters, theatrical release, but here it was on HBO. And I saw Harvey Weinstein at Cannes and I hadn't seen him and I hadn't seen him since. He had passed on Behind the Candelabra. So I asked him, I was like, "What? Why did you fucking pass, man? This is like a classic Miramax movie." And he remembered it was a year later or a year and a half later. And he was like, "It's a $23 million movie. I got to put at least that into P&A. That's at 50. I got to split it with the exhibitor. So now I got to make $100 million. Now, I like you and Michael and I like Steven, but do I believe that movie's going to make $100 million? Definitely. And once it does, then I start to see profit." He goes, "That's a tough bet." He goes, "Now that I've seen it, I should have done it probably." But he goes, "It's just really..." Because that's the business. And so if you don't have a DVD behind that, right, that or are these other ancillary monies that are gonna backstop you, it's what ends up happening, right? So I produced this movie Manchester by the Sea a year or two ago. That's a classic movie. Like had we made it 20 years ago, we would have made it for $20 million, right? We made it for 8.8. And we only got 8.8 because Kimberly Stewart, who runs K Period, came in and like independently financed it. The best other offer we got was $4 million from Amazon. And we were like, we can't make it for four. We can barely make it for eight.
But what's sad is that movie was exactly the type of movie you and I grew up with.
Yes. And the kind of movie
that we
loved.
The Kramer versus Kramer type of movie that got made, The Verdict. All those movies got made over and over again my entire childhood.
Yes. And that was the kind of, that's why I wanted to be an actor, were those movies, right? Those kitchen sink dramas. And the problem is that, so you can still make them, right? Nobody gets paid any money. You know, the crew gets paid, and you know,
well, now you have to hope it's like, and you're basically making it to try to win an award,
right? And the only reason we won some awards with that was, I mean, I not the only reason, I'm very proud of the movie, but Amazon picked us up after and kind of were using us to prove themselves as a content, you know, prestige content provider.
Yeah.
So it was like getting hit by a bus.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked to marketing people from other studios who were like, they've probably spent 40 or north of $40 million on the campaign for the movie, right? So it was suddenly everywhere. That was because we had this big engine behind us, but
well, they were trying to legitimize their own business.
Right. So we were just in the right place at the right time. But going back to the production side of it, like, had we had more money to make that movie, you know, I love Manchester. I'm incredibly proud of it. But Kenny had an ending. There was this scene where they were all on these boats. They were on the boat that the whole movie's kind of about. And it was a flashback to when before Casey's kids had died, before his brother had died, when he was still married to Michelle. And it was this thing. They were all on this boat and they were whale watching. Right. And it's this incredible moment of joy. And you see this family all together. And then these whales start breaching out of the water. And it's just, and you needed fucking drone cam and a fucking, I mean, it was one day of shooting. Right. And you got to get lucky with the whales. But either way, like, we could have figured that out. But it was this epic. And so as the camera pulls back, as this family is experiencing this incredible joy, and you know it's about to go horribly wrong for them, right? The camera's pulling up, 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 and it reveals all of these other boats all around it. And it's all these other families that are watching these whales, right? And it's like, this is one little story in this sea of stories, right? And it was epic and it was beautiful and it like tied the whole thing in. And it was, and we ran out of money. You know what I mean? And it's like, fuck. Like, if, in retrospect, like, we could have done that, but you don't know that it's Manchester until it comes out and everybody goes, holy shit, it's great. You know, I mean, more often than not, it's so hard to make those movies work. And there just used to be in the 90s so much more, the margins were so much greater that you had more money to swing and miss with. And as a result, you got better stuff.
What's the most surprised you've ever been that a movie you made didn't work?
There have been quite a few, man, that I really wished worked better. Downsizing, I was really bummed out about.
You thought that was going to hit?
No, I just thought, well, I thought the critical response would be better because I believe we made what Alexander told me we were going to make, which was a Hal Ashby movie with special effects, you know? And it's so fucking weird.
That's a good sell job.
It is. It is. It was perfect for me. That was all I needed to hear. But it's this, it takes this such a bizarre left turn.
Yeah.
Right. That's so insane. Like, that they're going down the fjords in Norway and he falls in love with this one-legged Vietnamese political dissident who ends up, you know what I mean? And yet it's all this life affirming kind of, and it was so bizarre, but wonderfully bizarre that I thought film critics would go, this is the fucking kind of thing that people need to be making more of. Like, I'm so glad somebody put money into the, and instead it was like the opposite. It was like, what? Kristen Wiig doesn't get small and they don't have, it's not a screwball comedy. Like, what's going on? And I was just shocked by, not shocked. I mean, never shocked, but I would have bet that one wrong. I bet, obviously, I'm in it.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're all bets, I guess, to a certain degree. Like, you know where I stand based on whether I said yes or not.
Well, the flip side of that would be The Martian, right? You knew that was going to be potentially good, but you didn't know it was going to be like
no,
a phenomenon.
And there was a lot more risk in The Martian because it was just me and it was going to be perceived as just me. And I remember having that long conversation and going like, all right, do I do this? This is, if this one misses, it would be bad.
Right.
Because it's a lot. It's a $110 million movie. I mean, Ridley did it for $108.
And you're in half of it by yourself, basically.
Yeah. And it would be a kind of a personal rebuke if people just were like, fuck that, I don't want to see it. You know what I mean? Like, it would be hard to, whenever one of these things doesn't work, you're always playing that shell game, right? Your agent's out there going like, yeah, but here's what happened. Here's what really happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And to a large extent, that's true. You know what I mean? It's. I always tell people, you don't see the movie before you make it. You know, you get the ingredients for whatever you're cooking, and you get to see what the ingredients are, and you go, all right, with all these people around, we should be able to do something pretty good. And or hopefully great. Like ideally you're starting out everyone hoping that it's great, and eventually you end up with something, you know, good. And some of them just don't work. And
I think it's like baseball. You can't go 4-for-4 every game.
Right. Yeah.
You want to go 2-for-4, 3-for-4 with a dinger.
Right.
Occasionally you might go 4-for-4, and sometimes you're gonna go 4-for-4. But I mean, this is like 25 years. You're cranking them out.
Yeah.
There's going to be a couple of downsizes that go, there you go. Oh man, what happened?
Yeah. And yet looking back on it, like I would take that movie again. I mean, Alexander Payne, I mean, that's the first movie he had that wasn't a critical and box office hit, you know, maybe I killed him.
The only one I would have stopped you from was the golf movie.
Ugh.
You couldn't swing a golf club.
I'd never swung one before.
I know.
I had less than a month to learn. I talked myself
into
that.
You speed rushed.
I speed rushed a game that you cannot speed. But I know it was. And also just, it just, look, don't get me started. It's over 20 years and it's still painful. But I really, really wanted to work with Robert Redford.
Yeah.
And Ordinary People was kind of a touchstone for us. And
yet another movie that wouldn't get made now.
Right. Right. And I got a lot out of it. I got a lot out of working with Will. I loved Will. I mean, what a gentleman that guy is, and really does it right.
So it seems like you were trying to have experiences with different types of
directors, yeah.
Directors, stars, whoever, like yeah. Trying to glean certain things from whoever.
Yeah, not making,
which is smart.
Not what's the saying? Not making. Great, the enemy of good, like not like just working. Like the other thing was this whole upheaval in my life was happening, and I'd get more uncomfortable when I wasn't working. Like,
yeah.
So I really put my head down for like 5 years and just stayed on the road and worked and felt very protected in, you know, among movie crews, among, you know, there was none of that fame shit and none of that stuff kind of infecting those dynamics.
Did you see what was happening from the outside with you and Affleck, where people were kind of pigeonholing you as these two, like Affleck somehow became the guy from the movie from Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
You were like the smart guy who was making career choices and he was the dumbass who's just making big budget movies.
Yeah. And that was really hurtful, to be honest. Like I remember the first time was Saturday Night Live, seeing Saturday Night Live and they portrayed Ben as like some fucking Neanderthal.
Yeah.
You know, who literally couldn't talk. And it was so offensive and so not true. And so kind of, it's like, so we shot Good Will Hunting. I remember Ben, we were in, after seeing like a rough cut of the movie or something, we were at Miramax and Ben asked Harvey to please call Michael Bay. Because he was up for this movie Armageddon. And I remember thinking, oh, that's really smart because maybe Michael Bay will listen to Harvey or maybe that'll tip the scales for you. Like, I would have done Armageddon.
Yeah.
We had no idea where things were going to go for us. We needed jobs, right? And I had lucked out and been cast in Saving Private Ryan, right? So those movies came out the following summer. Armageddon and Saving Private Ryan came out the same summer. And then it was like, oh, Matt's the serious guy and Ben's the big popcorn movie guy. And it was just like, no, I mean, we would have done the other job. You know what I mean? So it was just terrifically unfair. And then it took a long time for Ben to kind of right that ship publicly. Privately, everyone who knows Ben knows Ben, but it wasn't until I think, you know, he started directing and started directing some really good movies and then won Best Picture that people were like, oh, fuck, he's really smart, you know?
Yeah, his career's had a lot of incarnations, but it's been a lot of things that we've seen before with other people's careers, you know? Like Hollywood loves a comeback.
Yeah, yeah.
You could see it when he did Gone Baby Gone. It was like, oh, Affleck, he's back. It's like, well, right. We were all burying him. Like, it's,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
He was there the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he whether he internalized that criticism, I don't know, but certainly he handled it way better than I can. I'm way more thin-skinned. And maybe that's why he takes bigger swings. Maybe he's like, fuck it, I'll play Batman. You know, I never would have done that. I've been like, why? You know, the downside. Why? Don't do that.
I actually did a mailbag when I was at Grantland, and somebody asked me why Ben Affleck did Batman, because he was, you know, he was on this great run. And I was like, this is kind of like his fuck you role.
Yeah.
Like, everyone accounted him out. He made this huge comeback. And this is like the 07 Pats thrown deep to Randy Moss when they're up 48-10.
Right. Yeah.
You know, he's like, fair. Fuck this. Fuck you. I'm going to be Batman.
I think that's true. And I think there's also the very real aspect of his son was 3 and
trying to impress your son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
people don't realize that. Actors Batman just want to impress their kids.
I remember being at Ben's birthday party years ago and Toby was there, and Ben and Toby had a conversation about, and Toby was just talking about what his son thinks. He goes, when Otis sees me, he goes, it's, you know, it's a real thing, man. Yeah. It's fucking cool. My kid, even for a couple years, thinks I'm Spider-Man or thinks, you know, and so I think that was definitely a very real component to him doing that.
You
know?
So when you make
and some- also because Ben classically thinks he can fix everything. He is the most optimistic. I've said this about him for, you know, we used to go to movies and we'd come out and our whole group of friends, what'd you think? Well, that sucked. And Ben would go, yeah, but you know what would have made it better? This and this and this and this. And he would literally just script doctor it in the parking lot. And suddenly he'd make a movie that everyone wanted to see. And so early on in his career, I think he got put in these situations where he knew how to script doctor it and they weren't letting him. And so then, so what directing allowed him to do was be the person making the decisions. And that's why the movies that he directs are really good. Because
you never really wanted to go down the directing road.
I do. I really want to direct. And I almost directed Manchester. I almost directed Promised Land, which is this little movie about fracking.
Oh, that's right. You Manchester fell through, right? You were supposed to direct that.
I was going to direct it. And then I was like, wait, I'll play the role. Because Kenny Lonergan had a really bad experience with his previous movie. And it was, when I read the script, I was like, Kenny, man, you got to direct this. This is, you know, this is not a writing assignment. Like you got in there and this is your story to tell. And
maybe you can direct the Father of the Bride remake that you're going to do to impress your daughters.
Actually,
if you want to impress your daughters, remake idea. That movie, make this sequel. Bride.
Oh God. There are movies like that that we could bring back around. I'm sure that would.
That one. I mean, there's some certain dad daughter movies that are out there.
Yeah.
And that's like one of the icons. But
yeah,
I think with Netflix throwing around the money, I forgot to ask you before we go, Rounders 2.
Yeah.
It was going to happen.
Well,
every time I saw you, I asked you about it.
And
Koppelman,
I was like,
wanted to happen. It's not happened. It's 2018.
You know, we had Koppelman and Levine had a whole pitch. They pitched it to Harvey. Harvey said yes in the room and then never called back. And so
I'm pretty sure you guys could get Rounders 2 made.
I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting. Like in this, you know, I mean, what would it cost? I mean,
I'm pretty sure Netflix just greenlit it listening to somebody at Netflix right now.
Well, we do it. If Netflix wants to do it, we'll do it. I mean, it's a great, like, what happened to these, you know, what happened to these characters? And have they ever told you the pitch? It's really good. I mean, it's really good. And it's everybody. You know what I mean? It's like, we'd want Dahl to come back and direct Edward, John, you know, everybody, all of us. Like, what happened to the whole group?
Well, the best part of the fact that Mike McDee at the end of that movie goes to Vegas.
Right.
And he's like, World Series of Poker, could this be my day? But it's 1998.
Right.
I'm watching. I barely know anything about poker. I don't really know the World Series of Poker. It wasn't on TV, or if it was, I wasn't watching it. But then Moneymaker happens in 03. This movie gets
that was belated. A big one. Moneymaker was a big one. Yeah.
And now Mike McDee trying to win the World Series of Poker, like, it actually made the ending seem so much more realistic. Snap catch up with him in the late 2000s. I don't know.
Well, and do you think he's Johnny Chan? Like, is he that good? Like, is he one of those guys? And I always saw him as one of those guys. But the question would be, right, these new kids coming up on the online.
And he's like one of the old lions.
And he's one of the old lions, right. And so it's like there's these different generations. There's the Doyle generation, right? There's the Mike McD generation, right?
It's like
my generation, which are kind of caught in between. Like, and then there's the new fucking cyborg generation, right? And these kids are kids, whatever, young men and women are amazing guard players. And so can the analog generation, the kind of crossover generation, compete with that? And how do all of these characters who are all a part of that generation, Edward and Turturro and Malkovich and, you know, all of those players are in that generation. So how would they?
It's like you and Daniel Negreanu and Phil Hellmuth,
right.
Phil Hellmuth and Phil Ivey.
Right.
Mike McD's like, he's one
in,
of those
he's
guys.
In that cohort. Right?
Yeah, exactly. He's in that group.
Yes.
So I was thinking, you know.
Seidel. Yeah. Yeah.
Seidel needs a win in rounders too.
Seidel needs a win. Seidel should just beat the shit out of me in rounders too. I owe him. I definitely owe him.
Rounders
that.
Two, Seidel beats Mike McD in the World Series of Poker.
Exactly.
And then cries.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was thinking with if rounders two never happens, I think the natural thing is Billion season 8. Mike McD is now a billionaire. And gets brought in.
I love it.
As he's running a hedge fund. He's been in a poker game with Axe from Billions.
Right.
It gets a little heated, and now he decides to destroy Axe. 4-episode arc.
I'm going to take down Axe Capital.
I think you should do it. Just think it. Keep it on your radar.
I'd do a 4-episode.
I don't know if your daughters would be impressed.
That show's awesome too. That show's really fun.
At some point, you're going to have to go on it.
I would love to. Yeah. I mean, I would. I'll have a lot of my friends are on that show.
I forgot to ask you, when Malkovich unleashed that Russian accent, what was your reaction in the room?
Oh, good. This is one of my favorite stories, actually. So the buildup to Malkovich getting there was extraordinary. I mean, it was like, you know, he had one of those deals where he was there for a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, we start shooting in December. You know, Malkovich is coming like February 1st. And so for the whole run of the show, it was like, Malkovich is coming. Malkovich, hey, kid, you ready? He's coming. You know, he's coming, right? Malkovich is coming. It was like this.
And he has real gravitas in the mid-90s.
Oh, fuck yeah.
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 He's like one of the most elusive, talented actors, enigmatic that we had.
Yes. And he also happens to be one of my closest friends, Terry Kinney, started Steppenwolf with him. And so I actually had a connection to him that kind of took him a little out of the icon status, which was nice, which was helpful for me.
Yeah.
Because it was the buildup was like, he's come, you know, you're going to be able to hold your own. You're sitting across the table from him.
Yeah.
So he shows up, and the first time we roll, he goes, "If you don't have my money, then you are mine." And they go, cut. And everybody just spontaneously erupts into applause.
Oh, they were just in right away.
Oh, they're like, fuck, he's amazing. And it's just me and him.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at him across the table. Like, what are you doing? And then they go, take two. If you don't have my money, then you are mine. And again, they erupt into, you know, the crew's like, fuck, he's here. Malkovich is here. And I just was looking at him and he sees me. I guess I'm like giving him the one eye. I don't even mean to. And he like leans over the table and he kind of beckons for me. And I lean across the poker table and he whispers in my ear and he goes, "I'm a terrible actor." It was the fucking greatest. It was like, there was so much in that, you know what I mean? That I still to this day like treasure, because it's like, you have to keep fucking grinding. Like sometimes people aren't going to tell you, you know, which is not to say that I didn't like his performance in the movie. I loved it. And the accent, he was walking around with a tape recorder, the actress from Burnt by the Sun, the Russian movie that had won the Oscar. She had recorded all of his lines for him. So it wasn't that he was grinding, but... But, you know,
I actually think it hurt the first viewing of the movie, like when you're in the theater for it, but then it gains steam each time. Well, I remember in the theater being like, what the fuck is going on? He's going to talk that way the whole time. But 20 years later, it's like, I'm so glad he did it that way.
Me too. Me too.
It's so much better.
It is. It is. And he just absolutely was like at an 11 for everything, for the whole thing, you know, and it was brilliant, you know.
Can we agree that Mike McD, after he wins the 60 grand at the end, and he kind of taunts Teddy KGB about it and says, I could go on busting you all night, that the Russians just immediately kill him.
Amazing that, you know,
there's no way he gets out of there.
Well, the other thing I never, you know, he's got, you know, the Fomka's character, you know, Fomka Jensen, who it keeps saying to him, why don't you come back and play cards? And why didn't they get married? Right. He was like, she kisses him at one point. She's like, she wants to be in a relationship with him. I'm like, Mike, what's your problem? Like, she seems to get you. Like, you guys really like to do the same stuff. Like,
this is, so I've known Koppelman and Levine since I wrote about Rounders when I was at ESPN a million years ago. And this is my number one question I ask them. And I bring it up like every 2 years. Like, she comes back in. His girlfriend's moved out. His wet blanket girlfriend that just didn't really like him and approve of poker.
Gretchen, the great Gretchen Mall. We shout her out, please. Yeah.
Well, she didn't like Mike McD. She didn't support his poker.
They were in law school together. She was like, she didn't get it. She didn't get it. And she was like, you have this shot at a career at a lawyer. Like, get your shit together. You know, she was way more traditional. And he was like, I can't do that.
Well, we didn't need her in the movie. What we needed was... Famke comes in, you have no furniture left. You're watching Johnny Chan, some old poker thing. And she comes in and is like, oh, the 1989 World Series of Poker.
Right.
Watch the discipline. And then she wants to have sex with him and he turns her down.
Yeah. I didn't,
and it's one of the biggest mistakes in movie history.
Yeah.
They know it though. They admit it.
I'm not going to fight you on that one. I didn't get that at all. It's also, I mean, she totally gets the guy. You know what I mean? Like, the most important thing in his life is the most important thing in her life. Like, how could they have, like, how did that relationship go off the rails? Because it's like, they kind of, I think they suggest that there was a relationship before for them, right? So it's like, well, what happened?
Maybe that's part of Rounders too.
Well, they should be married. Definitely.
But now the Russians are involved.
Right. And
the Russians, you know, in 98, the Russians, it was like post-Cold War. Not quite as dangerous as they were in the 80s with the Ivan Drago era. And now it's back. They're dangerous again.
Right. I wonder how dangerous Teddy KGB is.
He's dead. I think they killed him after he lost the 60K.
We got to bring back Malkovich.
Make this happen. You're a powerful man.
Believe me. There are so many movies that I can't get made. It's incredible.
What are you talking about?
I'm telling you, dude. It's
You made five Bourne movies.
I know. Those are the easier ones to get made nowadays. Those bigger ones, oddly enough, are actually easier to get off the ground a lot of the time.
You couldn't stop Fever Pitch, though.
I know. Well.
Come on.
I love Pete and Bobby. I never saw Fever Pitch, to be fair. But
no, we need the right Red Sox fan. The right Red Sox movie has not happened.
Well, they also had their whole... They had to rewrite, I remember, the ending because we won in 04.
It did kill the movie. So it didn't kill us, but it killed the movie.
It certainly didn't kill us.
I was saying to somebody recently, the fact that the Red Sox can go in a swoon with the Yankees nipping at their heels all of a sudden... used to be the worst thing that could happen to me and would ruin my summer. And now it bounces off me and I'm not scared at all. And it's the biggest thing that's changed in my life.
That's
not
actually
that fear.
People who aren't from Boston I don't think could appreciate the level to which that is true. And that something so deeply and psychically or kind of existentially important changed for us in 2004. Like in a deep, deep, deep way. Everything changed. Like
it was like living in a house in a terrible neighborhood and being afraid you're going to be robbed every night. And then all of a sudden you got the best security system ever and you had like four armed guards outside. And it's like, all right, I'm going to go.
No, or you just walked out the next day and the neighborhood was really nice. You're like,
oh, what happened?
Man, this place is fine. I love this place.
My God.
Yeah, it really... it doesn't get me the way it used to. It just was, It was responsible for like an underlying kind of baseline of anger, I think, in like everybody from the greater Boston area. I remember going to the walking up onto Boylston Street and watching the duck boats go by and just by myself just crying. I mean, really, you know, I was 34 years old.
In Good Will Hunting, it immortalizes the fist comber, which was kind of like how we won the World Series as Red Sox fans, even though we actually didn't win the series. But people felt like we won the World Series because we won that game. That was as close as we were going to come.
Yeah. Oh, God. And Aaron Boone was the year before. It's just a disaster.
Yeah, it's terrible. Matt Damon.
Did we talk enough about Rounders?
I didn't ask you about the climactic poker confrontation scene in Rounders because that's the last thing we can hit. Because in the beginning of the movie, you when he gets cleaned out, and I called it when I wrote about the movie, I called it the Mike McD face, which is that kind of all my money's gone, which is the same face. The reason I think you were able to pull it off, because it's a really good, memorable face, but it's the Buckner Schiraldi face. We just lost the World Series in 13 pitches face.
And fucking Koppelman's like a Mets fan.
So you're just able to tap into that and do it.
They had that line about Buckner walking back into Shea, I remember, in the voiceover, which I ended up doing, but it was a highly contested line. I was just like, I don't want to say it out loud. I don't want to say that out loud. And Brian said, but it's the perfect metaphor.
Yeah.
It really is. And I said, I understand why it's like, I understand why you wrote it, guys. It's very hard for me to say.
What did you try to change it to?
I didn't. I didn't even suggest an alt. I just said, just give me a minute.
Can I regroup?
Yeah. It's like, it's like getting punched in the stomach is how, and how they referred to it, Brian and David, because Brian had been felt it a couple of times and he goes, think of it that way, because that's what it is. It's like a physical. It's like someone just uppercutted you to the stomach.
It's actually the perfect analogy, and I don't know. Even though that movie's 20 years old, I still think it's the right sports analogy. I don't know what else.
No, I don't either. I don't.
Nothing's really happened since that. It was probably worse than that, where you have like Buckner Shea. I know exactly what that is. I know exactly how much pain immediately.
I
think it still works. So then you have the game. Do you feel like you're good at faking being a poker player at this point, or do you actually feel like you're a poker player?
No, I definitely didn't feel like a poker player. I felt like, you know, unlike the golf movie, I had about 30 days to learn how to play poker too.
Yeah.
But luckily there wasn't a physical manifestation like a swing with which you could see, you know what I mean? I got to watch a lot of people play. And so I got to observe them play and see how little they do, you know, because you obviously don't want to, you don't want to tip your hand, right?
But it's a little attitude smack talk too, which is.
There was more back then. Yeah. Now guys are just in their sunglasses.
Get the AirPods
on. And, you know, their hats over their faces. And it's like, you might as well be playing online. But back then there was a lot more. Talking. And Brian got me into those games. Like, you know, we had a technical advisor named Mike Selza who ran one of those clubs, I think, or knew people or whoever it was, but he got us in and I got to sweat some of these players, you know, and that's when they allow you to sit behind them and look at their whole cards and you know, and watch how they're playing the hand. And so it was just, that was all just based on kind of what I saw in those situations, but also the dynamic. Look, I'm a writer also. So I know there's got to be some drama. It can't be, you know, the hat down and the sunglasses. It's the showdown with, you know, your antagonist, and it's the it's the duel at the end, right? In the middle of the Main Street.
And the Oreos.
Right. And the Oreos, right. Which was, I mean, a little bit of a tell.
Yeah. But the thing is, when I saw that movie and I didn't know that much about poker, I missed it. I didn't totally get it in the moment, you know.
It's so big, right? And in shot and so close up, such close up. It as I remember, I haven't seen it in a long time, but it's almost kind of it almost hides behind how big we made it.
Yeah.
In a sense, because it becomes about Malkovich, and it's just this kind of juicy close up, and then later you realize, oh, he's unscrewing the Oreo next to his ear. Like,
it's one of the biggest tells you could have.
It's like the worst tell of all time. but the way Dahl shot it, I think, was really cinematic and beautiful, and kind of we got away with it.
So Rounders 2, you're ready? Ready for something?
I've been, you can ask Koppelman, man. We've been talking about it. We just don't, I don't know if the Weinstein Company has the rights to it. I don't even know if the Weinstein Company exists anymore. I mean, it was in like, so I don't even know what happens.
What happens to all the stuff they have the rights to?
Yeah, they probably own all this IP that they'll probably try to sell off. So maybe by saying I want to do it, you know, we're fucking us, because then they're going to try to rob a bank when they sell it, you know?
And or they're just never grabbing what they can get.
What's that?
They're grabbing what they can get when they finally sell stuff off, maybe.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, you might need to get
Affleck in this.
Well, he's the real card player.
I know,
actually.
He plays all the time.
Yeah, he's genuinely good. I mean, you have to play so often to be genuine. I mean, he was good enough to win. I mean, he beat 350. I mean, it was like TJ Cloutier. Like, they were like legit people that he beat in that tournament. I think it was like $350,000 or something he won.
He's no Toby, though.
No.
People are like afraid of Toby Maguire.
Yeah, I've only played with Toby once, and Ben said, like, don't ever, ever, ever get involved in a hand with him. Like, he is not only, he's like the best, you know, celebrity card player. He's like, it's not even close. He's like, he's just legit by, I mean, I think I think that's his major source of income. I think, because the other thing is like,
it's like NBA players that he's playing poker against?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there were, like Annie Duke, who used to train Ben, they were friends, and she gave him lessons, right? And taught him really how to play. And she used to get played back at a lot when she was in Montana, because she was a woman, right? And these guys, right? She knew that at some base level, they couldn't believe that she was that fucking much better than they were, right?
Yeah.
She was just, oh, I'm just little Annie. I just don't, oh, what am I doing, right? And she just smoked all of them, because she was a world-class player. And so what she was really good at with Ben was teaching him how to use his kind of celebrity the same way in those games, right? You get in those games and people are like, it's fucking Ben Affleck. What does he know?
Yeah.
Right? It's a fucking actor, right? And meanwhile, he's a fucking assassin.
Yeah.
And you just lost $20,000 to him, right? Like a Wall Street person, right? And then there's the Wall Street. There were people just like, I don't care. I just want to be in a hand with Ben Affleck. But so those games, those cash games, I think got crazy. And I think Toby, you know, Toby's like, by all accounts, I mean, I'm, you know, by all accounts, he is like a world-class poker player.
Maybe that's the plot for Rounders 2.
That just
Mike McTee's in a blood feud with Toby Maguire, but it's the real Toby Maguire.
It's actually Toby Maguire. I thought you were just going to suggest Toby plays Mike McTee, which would actually be good too.
No, it's like a Being John Malkovich thing where he's actually in the movie as Toby himself. Maguire. Or when Julia Roberts was in Ocean's 12 as herself.
Right.
That could be good. That's I think great. We came up with it. Matt Damon, this is fun. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.